This class is on the topic is political entrepreneurship and the economics of wealth destruction, and I've written several books about this over the years, and so I'm sort of an expert on how to destroy wealth, I guess, and maybe my next career I'll learn how to make money, but in this career I learn how people destroy money and wealth, and so. So my interests have always been sort of a combination of political economy or public choice and Austrian economics, and so this talk would be a sort of a combination of those two areas. Hans Hoppe calls it Austrian social theory, the integration of political economy with straightforward Austrian economics, and I guess it starts with there's an old truth. And this doesn't come from modern economics. This idea has been around a long time that there are only two basic ways to make money in the world. One is to produce a good or a service that other people will voluntarily purchase for you. As Adam Smith said in The Wealth of Nations, "Give me that which you want, and I will give you that which give me that which I want, and I will give you that which you want." I think that's an exact quote from The Wealth of Nations, and that's a definition of free market capitalism. I will give you what you want, you give me what I want. You know, I want money, you want my car, here's my car, I'll take your money. And so that's one way of making money, working through the institutions of entrepreneurship and private enterprise. The other way of making money, I guess there are three ways of making money. A second way of making money is theft. Holding a gun to someone's head and saying, "Give me your wallet," that can be profitable for some people. Some people make money that way. Third way of making money is legal plunder or legal theft. That is, using the auspices of the state, recruiting the state to help you make money one way or another. If you're in the mousetrap business, let's say, you can make money by trying to produce better or cheaper mousetraps that people will like and will buy and will give you money for them. Or you can lobby the government, bribe them, to pass a law prohibiting the importation of all foreign mousetraps. And the end result will be an increase in the price of mousetraps. And from the consumer's perspective, all they get is higher prices. They get no value in return. As opposed to market exchange, free market exchange, you get value in return for your money, and so you got peaceful exchange is one avenue of acquiring money or wealth. Then you've got illegal theft, and then you've got legal theft, which is sometimes called taxation or social justice. Some people call it social justice, but it's legal theft and. And libertarians have long said taxation is theft, but don't forget it's also a form of slavery. The U.S. Constitution prohibited slavery. With the post-war amendment, the 13th Amendment after the Civil War, and involuntary servitude. The actual language is involuntary servitude. But ask yourself this: when you are forced with the threat of imprisonment to work for 4, 5, 6 months out of the year, solely for the benefit of somebody else, what would you call that? What would you call it? Well, what other than slavery or servitude would you call such a thing? And so it's called social justice by the state as a way to bamboozle the beer and pretzel crowd, as Judge Napolitano calls them, or the bourgeoisie, as H.L. Mencken called the general public. But the truth is, it's theft, and it is a form of slavery. And so there's an inherent contradiction, in other words, in the U.S. Constitution. The 16th Amendment that brought in the income tax contradicts the 13th Amendment that ended slavery and involuntary servitude, because the 16th Amendment resurrected involuntary servitude. It forces you to work for someone else. And if you were to look up on the web, Tax Freedom Day, I think the National Taxpayers Union in the U.S. calculates Tax Freedom Day. That's the day in which the average American can finally stop working to pay taxes and start working for himself. And it's usually mid-May or June, early June, something like that, if you add up all the taxes, the federal, state, and local. But I don't believe that even includes the implicit tax of government regulation. So if you include the effect of government regulation on how it raises the price of everything, you know, Tax Freedom Day is probably the 4th of July or something like that. So maybe that's what we should celebrate on the 4th of July, is not we're finally, we're no longer slaves. Okay, sort of Emancipation Proclamation Day, 4th of July. And so those are the two basic ways of making money, or three basic ways. There's, you know, peaceful exchange, crime, and legal crime of making money. And legal crime is what I'm talking about with regard to political entrepreneurship. And one article or book that I would recommend on this, and it's an old classic. This is one of Murray Rothbard's favorite publications. And I better press this button here. That's not it. There, see. It's online, A Disquisition on Government by John C. Calhoun. Calhoun was a vice president of the United States. He was a secretary of war for a while. He's a United States senator from South Carolina. And he's generally considered to be the last, philosophically, the last of the American founding father generation. He died in 1850, so he was way past Jefferson and the original founders. But philosophically, in terms of his theory of government, he was the last one to write such things as this, as a politician, as an American politician. And Rothbard quotes this book all over the place in many of his writings. And one of the reasons he quotes it, and Rothbard called him arguably America's best political philosopher in all of American history. He liked him so much. But the reason Rothbard liked him so much was that this book is, among other things, an exposition of the libertarian class theory. Libertarian class theory, which is very different than Marxian class theory. Marxian class struggle theory tells a story about a supposed struggle between the capitalist class and the working class. But the conflict in libertarian class theory, which goes back several hundred years before Calhoun, he was, I think he first got into the Senate in 1803 or something like that. But back in the 17th century, there were French philosophers who were writing about this idea of libertarian class theory long before it was ever called libertarian class theory, and Calhoun didn't call it that either. But the basic conflict in society, it has long been known, is not between the working class and the capitalist class, but between what Calhoun called the net taxpayers and the net tax consumers. And the net taxpayers are people who pay more in taxes to the state than they receive in any kind of benefits from the state. The net tax consumers are people who receive more in benefits from the state, government employees, for example, government bureaucrats, than they pay in taxes. And so in terms of political entrepreneurship, Calhoun explained that a written constitution would never be sufficient, he thought, to control this, to control a democracy or a society where the tax consumers would eventually overwhelm the taxpayers. He thought it was inevitable unless something else superseded this. And you needed more than just this written constitution, because after all, when he wrote this book in 1850, he had already observed that the Constitution had already been pretty much thrown out the window with theories of implied powers. The new theory of the expansive interpretation of the Commerce Clause was already there. The expansive interpretation of the General Welfare Clause was there. We had a central bank, even though there was no delegated power to create a central bank. And so he thought it was already gone to hell in 1850, and which is why he proposed various things. One of them was a concurrent majority, that if the federal government proposed any legislation, then a state or a group of states could veto it by essentially nullifying it by saying we won't enforce it within our boundaries. And so And his idea there was that if the federal government knew that the people of the states had this power to monitor what is and is not constitutional, then the type of laws that would be proposed and passed would be more likely to be constitutional laws within the Constitution, because the politicians in Washington would know, what's the use? We pass this law, the people are not going to pay attention to it. But once the day came when the federal government itself said, well, we will use the guns that we have and the cannons and the tanks eventually to enforce this, well, then the people really had no say at all. And so that's why Calhoun proposed such things as his concurrent majority and nullification. Although nullification, the idea of nullification is mostly associated with Thomas Jefferson many decades earlier. Jefferson wrote the document called the Kentucky Resolve of 1798 that was meant to nullify the Sedition Act, which outlawed free speech in America. And so the Sedition Act actually outlawed free political speech. It made it illegal to criticize the Adams administration. John Adams was George Washington's successor as president of the United States. And so Jefferson and Madison adopted the idea of nullification. And then Calhoun picked up that idea decades later. The people, sort of the devious liars in and around the Beltway who want to confuse the public about this point, they always associate nullification only with Calhoun. They never admit that it was Thomas Jefferson's idea because Calhoun was a slave owner. You know, and so was Jefferson, but Calhoun is associated with sort of the philosophy of secession and the Southern Confederacy and all that. And so the game that is played is to try to tell people that, well, if you even say the word nullification, you must be a racist who wants to bring slavery back. And that's sort of the level of discourse in Washington, D.C. these days on such topics as the libertarian class theory. It's a way of censoring all discussion of this. It's a way of censoring and intimidating people out of even talking about the ways in which the people used to challenge state power through nullification and secession. But these are ideas that have to be stomped out and through character assassination first and foremost. And so, but it was Jefferson. It actually was before Jefferson that the idea of nullification was around. The colonists made efforts to nullify some of the king's edicts through nullification. It was Jefferson really just wrote up a very articulate exposition of this idea of nullification of laws from higher levels of government. Okay, so that's one thing. You know, this idea of the dangers of political entrepreneurship now have been recognized for a long time. Now, why is this important to economists? Well, the reason why it's important is that political entrepreneurship, or in the modern language of economics, it's called rent-seeking, although I prefer plunder-seeking, and because I believe that the purpose of government is for those who run it to plunder those who do not. That's, you know, you can read all the philosophers you want, but in reality, I think that's the purpose of government. And so rent-seeking is really plunder-seeking, and elections are really a contest to see who gets to plunder the population. That's basically what an election is. You know, George W. Bush was the plunderer in chief for his terms. Now Obama is the plunderer in chief, and they all take turns. They kind of take turns plundering and pillaging the rest of us, and of course making themselves very rich. You know, what did Bill Clinton do to be worth $100 million? By the way, you know, what great products has he produced and marketed? For example, how did Bob Dole retire a multimillionaire after being a public servant his entire life for 50 years? And so it's good to be a plunderer. And there was an article, and it reminds me of an article I wrote on lewrockwell.com several years ago. The title was A Nation of Chumps and Suckers. And because I was in a grocery store, and there was in the Washington, D.C. suburbs at the time, and there was the Washingtonian magazine, and the cover story was, how did we ever get so rich? ? And so here's Washingtonians reading an article about, you know, here we are, we're sitting around, boy, gee, we're rich as hell. How'd we get this way? And so I wrote an article about a nation of chumps and suckers. You know, there were all story after story about this congressman who served for a certain period of time, and then he retired from Congress, and he took a $3.5 million job for the pharmaceutical industry. And here's his house, by the way, in McLean, and they show these big mansions, you know, bigger than what the King of England lived in 200 years ago. And so that's the game. That's you can see the plunder, you know, right there. And our friends Richard Vedder and Lowell Galloway some years ago published a study, the Cato Institute published it, as I recall, where they took a look at the average income of people in the nation's capital compared to the average income in the country. And then they did the same thing for every state capital. They got data on the average income, you know, around maybe within 10 miles of the state capital of all 50 states compared to the rest of the state. And if I remember correctly, they found about a 40% premium, that on average the plunderers make about 40% more in wages and benefits than the people who they plunder. And so it's good to be the king. It's good to be the king. Now, the economic ramifications of this is that, you know, the whole story of rent-seeking is that you know, the more time and effort and money people spend trying to influence politics, by definition, the less time they're spending being productive. They're not producing goods and services. They're trying to use the levers of the state to rob Peter to pay Paul, to take money out of the pockets of one group to give it to the other group. That of course, is what democracy is all about. It's about taxing the productive and giving some of the money to the unproductive in society so that they will vote and keep in power the people who pull all these strings, the plunderers who pull all these strings. And so that's the game. And so if you play that game long enough, what you're doing is you're destroying wealth. Because the opportunity cost of spending endless hours in Washington trying to secure a subsidy or a wealth transfer is production foregone. You're not back at the factory producing goods and services, or you're not back in front of your computer trying to produce better software programs for Microsoft. You're in Washington trying to bribe politicians and kiss up to them and doing that sort of thing. And from a longer-term perspective, what you'll see is students like yourselves, more and more of you will be going to law school to become public relations experts or lobbyists or that sort of thing. And fewer of you will be going to engineering school or business school, where you would hope to be an entrepreneur or an engineer who creates products, because that's not where the money is anymore. The money is in stealing, in legalized theft. And so so the nation becomes poorer. There have been many books about this. One book by the late Mansur Olson, who was an economist at the University of Maryland for many years. Mansur Olson, you can look him up on the web. He passed away some years ago, but he was a well-known public choice theorist. And he used to, when he was to talk about political entrepreneurship and rent-seeking, the metaphor he would use was about the effect on the economy would be two sumo wrestlers. Imagine two sumo wrestlers, you know, these big fat guys who wear diapers and wrestle each other. It's a Japanese tradition. I don't know. I wonder who thought of that. Let's get two big fat guys and put them in diapers and have them, you know, ram their bellies into each other. So I don't know. I've never seen it live. I've seen it on television. But imagine two sumo wrestlers inside a China shop wrestling, and the winner gets to carry off whatever's left in the China shop. So they knock everything down and break all the dishes and everything, and there's one little goblet left, and the winner happily walks out with a teacup. You know, that's all that's left. And so that was Mansur Olson's metaphor about how this sort of process of rent-seeking or political entrepreneurship, if you will, destroys wealth. It destroys more than the winner walks off with. You know, the winner is a plunderer, you know, all these politicians, you know, the former congressman does have a nice house, but what he spent his life, if he spent his life as a part of the income redistribution game, well then, you know, he did a lot of damage. He destroyed far more wealth by his votes than he carried off with that nice house in McLean, Virginia, that he'll ever have. And so, like I said, I've written several books on this whole general topic about how it is that politicians go about devising all sorts of institutions that are used to plunder the population. And so I've always thought that You know, how else is the public ever going to learn about this unless we write articles and books about it and talk about it? Otherwise, they're going to just sit there and watch The Bachelor and drink beer and eat potato chips and just, you know, be the bourgeoisie. And so I thought I'd mention some of the books, the type of research I've done on political entrepreneurship and wealth destruction. And the first one was back when there was a bit of a tax revolt in America in the late 1970s, early 80s. You can even argue that the election of Ronald Reagan as president was sort of a manifestation of the tax revolt in America that had taken place. This was a time when the top marginal tax rate in the U.S. was 70%, 70 still. And I think family income had to be something like $160,000, and you're up in the 70% tax bracket. And also, property taxes had become very oppressive in a lot of states. So there was a tax revolt. There were something like several dozen states in the United States that passed laws that limited taxing, spending, and borrowing of all sorts. The most famous was Proposition 13 in California that it limited the growth of property taxes in California. And there are several dozen states though that did something similar. So at the time, my research agenda was asking the question, well, how are politicians going to respond to this? Because, you know, the classical theory of democracy that you're taught in school, in the government school, is that democracy is sort of like a perfectly competitive industry where the consumers express their wishes, and that is translated through the free market competition into products and services that give the consumer exactly what they want. And then you have, you know, equilibrium and all that stuff. And so if the theory of democracy that you're all taught in school is that, well, democracy is just like that, the will of the majority. Politicians respond to the will of the majority. And so the question was, well, will the politicians do this? Well, you know, they had vote after vote after vote to limit taxing, spending, and borrowing. And will they do this? Will they just say, okay, the people have spoken. We will obey. After all, we are your public servants. Don't they always call themselves your servants? And so what my co-author Jim Bennett and I found at the state level, state and local level especially, is that politicians did say this. They would always say, the people have spoken, we will cut or hold back spending and borrowing. But at the same time, they set up off-budget government enterprises and continued to spend at an even faster pace without even ever involving a vote of the population on the spending. And the vehicle they used was something called revenue bonds. And one of the masterminds of this was John Mitchell, who was Richard Nixon's attorney general, who was eventually convicted of a crime and kicked out. But he was a bond lawyer, a bond counsel in New York City before he became Nixon's attorney general. And he invented something called the moral obligation bond. And what this was the governments used to sell bonds to finance dormitory construction at the state government level or highways, whatever they're going to build. And they would promise that, well, we're going to build a dormitory, let's say, and then we're going to charge rent, and the rent from the students will pay off the principal and interest on the bonds. But people kept voting these things down in New York State. 3, 4, 5 times in a row, they would hold a referenda, and they would be voted down. And so Mitchell invented this kind of bond and said, well, there's no legal obligation for the state of New York to pay off the principal and interest. And so the bond buyers then would say, well, too risky for me. I'm not going to buy this bond. But there's a moral obligation, he said. And that was sort of a wink-wink to the bond buyers on Wall Street that we'll find the money somewhere in the general fund or something. Even if we don't raise enough money through the rent on the dormitories, we'll come up with the money. And so they did. So they just started selling these things to finance all sorts of things. And one of the most spectacular examples of this at the time was in Washington State, out in the northwest United States. They created something to fund 5 nuclear power plants, and it had an acronym. The name of this organization, this government organization, had an acronym. This was the acronym. And people pronounced it WHOOPS. And it was a Washington Public Power Supply System. The people out there said, we don't want five nuclear power plants surrounding our communities. We don't want that. And so they've kept voting it down. They kept doing what governments had always done, vote, take a referendum, and do you vote to tax yourself, increase your property tax somewhat, then we're going to build a nuclear power plant next to your house. And the people said, no thanks. And so they issued these a version of these moral obligation bonds that are called revenue bonds, and they don't require any voter approval. So they just sold them by the billions, But the people of the state were still on the hook to pay off the bonds. And so they simply thumbed their noses at the voters. The voters said, we don't want it. And the politicians said, well, yes, you do. And we're going to force you to pay for it. And they did. And so they commenced starting to build these five nuclear power plants. But in the end, it turned out to be the largest default in the history of municipal finance in the United States at the time. $2.5 billion of debt was defaulted on, and they ended up building nothing. They just tore it all down, and so that was an example of political entrepreneurship. And so that it pinpoints one big example between real entrepreneurship in the market and political entrepreneurship. Real entrepreneurship in the market, the only way to make money is to serve the consumer. One of my favorite passages in Human Action is the chapter on the market where von Mises talks about the consumer as being really the person in charge. You might think that it's the bankers and the corporate executives that make all the decisions regarding what gets produced, but it's really the consumer who is in charge, and he is the consumer is whimsical and on a whim the consumer can just dump you and pick up your competitor and cause you to go bankrupt. I think Mises calls them hard-hearted and callous in that regard, and that is true. But the whole game with political entrepreneurship, unlike market entrepreneurship, is to isolate yourself as much as possible from the people, from the consumers or the voters. That's what political entrepreneurship is all about. It's not serving the voters. It's doing whatever, it's continuing to plunder the population without having any sort of feedback mechanism that will punish you for plundering the population. That's what political entrepreneurship is about. And that's what this off-budget spending was all about. It was a way of isolating themselves from consumers voting on what they were doing. You know, if Jim Benn and I, when we're writing about this, constantly ask the question, well, if this stuff is in the public interest, as the politicians always say it is, why can't the public know about it? Why are they hiding it? Why is it all underground, as far as that? And we got the idea for the title, Underground Government, because I was at George Mason University at the time, and right across the street was the Fairfax County Housing Authority, and it was one of these green buildings, environmentally friendly buildings, and it was underground and had trees growing on the roof. And it was literally underground government. And we wanted to put a picture of that on the front of the book as a cover, but somebody, one of the lawyers with our publisher said, nah, they might sue you for something. So we couldn't do that because, you know, they have unlimited taxpayers' dollars to sue people for these things, I guess, underground government. And so that's one example. Another example is a book that Bennett and I also wrote. It's called Destroying Democracy. And one of the big issues, when Reagan first came in, one of the big issues of the day was that the Carter administration had spent billions of dollars just giving money to all these various nonprofit groups that were essentially lobbying organizations that would lobby for bigger government. And so here you have the government taxing people and giving billions to labor unions, the Sierra Club, welfare advocates, ACORN, all these groups that were just lobbyists for a bigger welfare state and so forth. And then they would use the money to lobby the government for what? For bigger government, higher taxes, and when they succeed, they would get some of that money and give some of it back to these nonprofit groups who would then lobby again for more government, and then the whole circle repeats itself. And if it was all illegal, the government had passed all kinds of laws saying, well, that's unjust and it's unfair for the government to finance one side of a political agenda. You know, it would be like... It'd be like, okay, we've decided there's the great debate over abortion. We're gonna give $1 billion to the anti-abortion groups, but nothing to the pro-abortion groups, or vice versa. Most people will think that's unjust, or you know, pick your issue, and do that. But that's what they were doing, and so so the title "Destroying Democracy," I got it from reading James Madison's Federalist Essay Number 10. Where Madison said that the whole purpose of a constitution was to control the violence of faction, that is, special interest politics. And if governments that failed to do that would, in history, eventually would destroy themselves, because the people would come to think that what government is doing is inherently unjust, and that could lead to a revolution, overthrow of the government, and replacing it with something else. And so to avoid that, Madison naively believed the Constitution would limit the government. But anyway, the argument there is that not only does government to this day not, of course, do anything to limit the government, but it uses tax dollars to grow the government. It uses your tax dollars, if you're a taxpayer, to actually destroy democracy, to expand it way beyond what the Constitution would allow it to be. And so that's another example of political entrepreneurship, generating the will of the majority. You know, all these groups produce massive propaganda. And so what basically goes on is, you know, there's a concept in public choice called rational ignorance. And this idea says that the average person is rationally ignorant of most of what goes on in politics, because we spend most of our time acquiring information about how to do our jobs, how to raise your family, how to get in through school, all your private affairs, how to get the bills paid. And we spend a little bit of time on social policy and so forth. But it really is impossible for any human mind to comprehend more than a tiny, tiny fraction of 1% of what the government actually does, because modern governments are so big and pervasive and involved in everything. You know, who knows what the NSA is up to, for example. The average citizen of Auburn, Alabama, probably has no idea of 99.9% of what the city government of Auburn is doing, let alone all the rest of it, the state of Alabama. You know, look up Google, government agencies of the state of Alabama, you'll probably find 30 or so different things. I did that once. They're even involved in regulating opera, I think. There was some bureaucrat that says has something to do if there's ever any opera in Alabama. I don't think there's ever been any yet, has there? Roger would know. Who has ever heard of opera in Alabama? But zoos, they have a zoo regulator and everything. And so it's impossible to know that. And so not only is the average citizen rationally ignorant, but much of what the average citizen knows is lies, myths, propaganda, and superstitions thrown at him by the state. As Tom Woods said last night, that everybody in America has been educated / brainwashed by government schools. Even the private schools, most of the teachers were educated at government schools, at state universities, or state-supported, state-funded universities. So just because it's private doesn't mean you're going to get a different education than in a government school. And homeschooling is the only out, but that's a relatively tiny percentage of the population. And so I don't know if I can repeat Tom's rendition of what this means, and that with generation after generation going through government schooling, but it basically means that we're all at the mercy of the food that we are served is poison. The cars that we drive are dangerous and will kill us. There are criminals lurking behind every tree, waiting to shoot us, knife us, and steal our money. And if it weren't for the grandiosity and generosity and magnificence of our politicians, of people like Nancy Pelosi and Newt Gingrich, we would all be just dead. We'd live maybe 20 years, and that'd be the end of it. And life would be nasty, brutish, and short for all of us. That's basically what we're all taught in school, some version of that version of life. And so this whole business of subsidizing all these nonprofit groups, which are giant megaphones of propaganda, if it's an environmentalist group, they spout their version of climate change and or whatever their thing is. If it's a labor group, they spout their propaganda. And so that led to another book that Bennett and I wrote called Official Lies, How Washington Misleads Us. So we wrote a whole book about this whole phenomenon of how rational ignorance is just half the problem. Public choice economists have been writing for many years about rational ignorance, but it's not just rational ignorance that's the problem. It's that what people think they know, much of it is just lies and propaganda about the market, about the evils of the market, and at the same time, the grandiosity of the state. And so so this book, you know, for example, I'll take one example of from Official Lies on the welfare state. The way the government issues these statistics on income inequality, at the time we were doing the research, we got the official governmental information about how they compute these statistics on income and income distribution in the United States. And what we found at the time was that they do not subtract taxes from the gross income of the upper brackets. And so when the government issues information about how unequal things are, they do not subtract taxes from the gross income. So they overstate the income at the upper end, and at the same time, they did not count any welfare benefits or food stamps or cash or in-kind benefits to people at the lower end. So they grossly understate the economic well-being of people at the lower end. And so we recalculated, you know, if you just did that, if you just counted the welfare benefits and all that, then the poverty rate at the time we were writing this, the government claimed was 13%. But by their definition, we recalculated it as 3%. If you just count all the benefits that people on welfare were getting. And so that's the type of lie that goes on. And of course, with farm programs, we had a chapter on getting down on the farm, I think was the name of the chapter. And the farm programs, are most of them are based on per acre subsidies for some reason. So if you have a million acre farm, you'll get a lot more money from the government for doing nothing than if you have a 1,000 acre farm. That you'll get paid for doing nothing for your farm, sort of farm programs. And so most of the subsidies to the farm programs go to large corporate farms, not the mom-and-pop farm that you think of, although they get their share also. And so we did have an entertaining chapter on I thought it was entertaining, on congressional hearings, which is pretty funny. We cited that when they had a new farm bill that Congress was talking about, they brought that great expert in agricultural technology, the actress Sissy Spacek, to testify, because she had just played a crying farm wife who lost her farm in a movie. And so they brought her to Washington, D.C. to cry in front of the cameras about the poor farmers. As though, I think she got paid $15 million for that movie she was in at the time. So maybe she was crying that she didn't get, that Tom Cruise got paid $20 million, and she only got $15 million, so she's crying about that. And then there was when they held hearings on Love Canal in New York State, there was supposedly a chemical spill in outside of Buffalo, New York, a little town called Love Canal, New York. They brought that great medical expert, Jack Klugman, who was an actor at the time, who played a doctor on television. And he played a doctor on television who had to deal with some patients who had, he thought they had cancer from a chemical spill. And so they brought him as a key witness to the hearings. And he actually did say, guys, I'm not a doctor. I'm an actor. We don't care. All the cameras were there because the cameras will come. And so that's the game with congressional hearings, is just to get the cameras there so that you can bloviate in front of the cameras, who are there because of the actors and actresses being there. So that was one chapter of Official Lies that we told. And so again, this is political entrepreneurship. This is one technique or one trick the politicians use, is the institutionalized lying that they use to keep the game of political entrepreneurship going, so that the people will be complacent. As Rothbard said in his great essay, Anatomy of the State, no state, no matter how tyrannical, can exist forever unless the people believe in a long series of myths and superstitions about the beneficence of the state and the evils of the civil society. And so the whole business of government When government, by the way, when government issues its announcements, it has the ability to overshadow all other voices, to shout out, to shout down everybody, because it's such a big megaphone. It gets the whole media to repeat endlessly whatever the president is saying, or whatever John McCain is saying about immigration, or whatever, as far as that goes. And so our voices tend to be just drowned out by the government. And so this is an important thing. The final type of political entrepreneurship I thought I'd mention is how, you know, remember I said that one of the key differences between political entrepreneurship and real market-based entrepreneurship is to be successful in the market, you have to please customers, you have to please consumers. All the great capitalists in American history who became very, very wealthy did it by figuring out how to produce things cheaply, good stuff cheaply for the masses. Rockefeller produced cheap petroleum products, and all the rest. You know, Vanderbilt figured out how to produce steamboat services very cheaply on the Hudson River. That's how Cornelius Vanderbilt got his start, and then he got into the railroad business. And, you know, how else can you make money in the railroad business if it's competitive, other than charging lower rates than everybody else? And so that's how all the great capitalists made their money, who were market capitalists and who were not rent seekers. But in politics, as I said, the opposite is true. The key to being successful in politics is to figure out ways of isolating yourself from any pressure from consumers or investors or stockholders. Of course, there are none in government. And in the U.S., the politicians in Washington have been very good at doing this. And here's one example. This is a chart on re-election rates of congressional incumbents over the years from 1964 to 2012. And as you can see, I'm not sure what the average is. Certainly, the average is probably as well over 80% as the average. And you see in 2012, it looks like it was about 95% of all incumbents get re-elected. And so the system has been pretty well rigged that, you know, the classical theory of democracy that I mentioned that you're all taught in school about how it really is a perfectly competitive model of democracy where the politicians do exactly what the people want. There is no principal agent problem. It's all rigged so that there is a principal agent problem, that our principals do whatever the heck they want to do. They don't do what the agents want them to do very, very often at all. Yeah, there are pressures to once in a while serve the public, but it's sort of like an accident whenever it happens. It's always a wondrous thing whenever they do something that, well, it seems to benefit just about everybody. When do you remember that ever happening? And so one of the reasons this happens, I have the same thing for the Senate. The Senate is not much better. Here's the United States Senate re-election rates. You know, and this is 100% up here. And so it's sort of the same way. And the reason for this, why it's almost impossible to lose your seat in Congress, is gerrymandering. I'll use a more colorful thing. Gerrymandering, the actual word gerrymandering is a combination of the two words. There was a politician in early America named Elbridge Gerry, Gery, and salamander. You know, salamander is kind of a squiggly-looking lizard. And so let's say you have the state of Kansas where Tom Woods lives. Here's Kansas. Yeah. You wonder who created these state lines at some point. They must have said, well, you know, it's kind of, yeah, you got these mountains in Appalachia, and so it's kind of tricky to draw the lines of here. But out in the Midwest, it's all flat, so let's just draw a bunch of squares. And, you know, here's Kansas, and here's Kansas. And say, so here's Tom's house. And here's Tom here in his house. And so let's say you had 6 congressional districts in Kansas. So, you know, the members of Congress are go to Congress from each state based on population. And let's, for the sake of example, let's say, okay, we're going to have six congressional districts. Let's make them like this. Here's District 1, 2, 3, 4. Tom's in District 5, and there's six congressional districts. That's one way to do it. That's when you decide, you know, Congressman X represents the people who live in this chunk of Kansas. You know, Congressman Y represents those people. That, of course, is not how it's done. I'll redraw the state of Kansas. Here's Kansas again. And here's Tom's house. There's Tom Woods in his house. And so here's District 1 might be like this. Here's Congressional District 1. I've shaped something like that. And the reason it's shaped like that is that when the Democrats were in the governor's house, they have the ability to redistrict, as they call it, to draw the congressional districts. And so in this particular configuration of the state, it might be, say, 80% Democrat. And so whoever runs for Congress from that district, if you're a Democrat, you're never going to lose because 80% of the people there are Democrats. And then over the years, you know, the Republicans win the governor's mansion and they'll do the same thing. They get the redistrict every 10 years. And so there might be another congressional district that looks like this. It includes Tom's house. And that might be 85% Republican. Okay, and so that'll be congressional district number 2 in Kansas. And so whoever runs for Congress from that district as a Republican will never, ever lose because 80% of the voters are Republicans. And so that's probably the main reason why we see these statistics of like 95% reelection rates in the Senate, because it's impossible. You know, once you're in Congress, you can do almost anything and get reelected. Everyone, yes, a few are reelected, a few retire every year. And I can recall years ago, I don't know, maybe 20 years ago or so, Congressman Barney Frank from Massachusetts was caught up in a scandal. It was in the front pages of the Washington Post for a whole week. You know, put yourself in this position. Say you're a member of Congress. He's in the very front page of the Washington Post for at least a whole week. That his male partner was running a house of prostitution out of the basement of his townhouse on Capitol Hill, and Barney claimed he knew nothing about it. And so you know nobody believed he knew nothing about it. How could you not know that there's strange men coming in and out of your house all night long with something like that? But still, he got reelected like 10 times after that. So you can even run a whorehouse out of your house as a member of Congress. And get, as long as you're good at bringing other people's money back to Massachusetts, they'll vote for you. I grew up in Pennsylvania, western Pennsylvania, and we had a lot of famous athletes there, like Tony Dorsett and Joe Namath, and Joe Montana is from there. People like that, but we also had some of the sleaziest politicians on earth from there. You know, this was like the labor union country and the steel mills and these places. And I'll never forget a congressman named Flood. Congressman Flood, he looked just like Snidely Whiplash in those old Bullwinkle the Moose cartoons. You know, he wore a cape, a black cape, and a big hat. And I don't know what they call these big wide hats. And he had a handlebar mustache. He's a member of Congress, the handlebar mustache, you know, with the wax on the end, and everything, Congressman Flood. And can you imagine this guy? And I always thought he was the perfect politician. If you want to have someone as the face of politics, the Congressman Flood, you know, Snidely Whiplash, that was it. That's what my friend Jim Bennett, he actually used to donate money to Senator Barbara Mikulski, even though Jim is a libertarian. And I asked him once, well, why are you giving her money? You know, Barbara Mikulski, she's a communist. You know, you send her money. And his explanation was, she is by far the ugliest person in Congress, and I want the face of government to be someone just hideous, just Barbara Mikulski. And so he gives her money. He gives her, send her $100 or something like that for a campaign and all that. I'll tell you a story about him that it was in a paper one. You know, who was in the movie Apollo 13? Was that Tom Hanks? Yeah. Tom Hanks. They made the movie, and they made it. They did some of it at the Space Center that is in Maryland. The state of Maryland has a Space Center. And so in the Washington Post, on the front page, there's Barbara Mikulski and Tom Hanks out at dinner because she helped, you know, through the government to get the film company the permission to shoot the Apollo 13 at the Space Center in Maryland. And so Jim calls up her office and said, this is the Washington Post. I'm calling to ask if there's any truth to the rumor that Senator Mikulski and Tom Hanks have a romantic relationship. And the person, he said, the person gets all unglued and, there's no truth to that. And then Jim says, well, then could you at least tell me what caused the breakup? Since there was no truth to that. And then they caught on. So he would sort of agitate Mikulski. I'm sure she laughed about that and give her money. But Flood looked like that. Well, anyway, Congressman Flood, a.k.a. Snidely Whiplash, he was convicted of some felony, naturally. But the way the Pennsylvania law was, he appealed, and the law at the time said, you know, if you appeal, you're not in jail yet, you can still run for re-election. And he won for re-election and won, you know, even though it was obvious to everybody, and he did end up going to jail. He lost his appeal. And so I remember reading articles in the paper asking people, everyone knows this guy's a crook. Why did you vote for him? And everybody, every single person in the paper said, well, they're all crooks, but our crook is really good at bringing money back to Western Pennsylvania for roads and libraries and post offices. So, you know, why not? And so that's the game also. And that brings me to the conclusion that besides gerrymandering, the second main reason for monopoly government like this that we see is that every member of Congress immediately gets themselves on the committees and subcommittees that are responsible for dishing out plunder to their constituents. You know, if you're from Kansas, you get on the Agricultural Committee. If you're from California, you get on the National Defense Committees because there are a lot of military bases in California. If you're from Newport News, Virginia, you get on the National Defense Committees because there's military bases in Newport News, Virginia. You want to ladle the pork in that direction. And of course, no challenger could possibly compete with this. You know, the incumbent can say, well, I will get a brand new aircraft carrier built in Newport News, Virginia, by getting $1.5 billion from the Congress. And here's, let's say, you know, one of us is trying to challenge this person. What can we promise? We'll promise. I'll take advice from Ron Paul and vote against everything. That's not going to work. And so that's the second reason why this persists. And the third reason is a congressional staff. Members of Congress have dozens of people that work for them that are paid for with tax dollars, and they are really, they're called staff, but they're essentially full-time campaign workers. Their main job is to get the boss reelected so that they can keep their jobs. And so, again, if you're a challenger, you have to raise money to pay people to work for you. But the incumbents, they use your money. They use the money of the challenger and everybody else, tax dollars, to pay for all these campaign workers. So, and that makes it uneven. And then, of course, another thing is that they've rigged the election laws, whereas it's almost impossible for a third party to be created. Jim Bennett, my friend I keep referring to, he wrote a whole book on this. And he actually got Ron Paul and Ralph Nader to pose with him for a picture to be on the book, you know, a left winger and then a libertarian, because they're both, you know, against this idea of not allowing third parties ever to operate. In his state of Virginia, for example, he found that I think if you wanted to run for Congress and you weren't part of the establishment, Democrats or Republicans, you had to get 10,000 signatures first. But if you're a Republican, you have to get zero signatures. Or a Democrat, you get zero signatures. You just, you know, you're the Democratic candidate. And so so that keeps this game going, too. So not only do third parties get made impossible to challenge, but challengers are impossible, almost, because of this. And so that's what examples of what I meant by how in political entrepreneurship, the game is to isolate yourself from any kind of pressure from voters, consumers, anybody else, and you're essentially a monopolist in plunder, and you can do what you want. And so that's why I said at the beginning what a democracy basically is a contest to see who gets to be the plunderer in chief. because that's what it's about. And maybe I'll stop there if anybody has questions or brilliant declarations to make, or a review of Bob Murphy's performance at the Sky Bar last night. If you would like to talk about that, I don't care. It's the last day. Or you can go drink coffee, since you all look hungover anyway. Okay, we'll call it a morning then, if no one has any questions. That's